So tonight, the focus of the talk will be about the third precept, the third of the five precepts that are a core part of the Buddhist teaching. And I've been doing talks at Asheville Insight Meditation since this Sangha was created a little over, it was 2010, so I guess that's 7 years? Yeah. And this is the third time I've gone through the precepts. You know, I go through all five. So I'm kind of the precept guy here. You know, this is sort of one of my niches. And, you know, it's kind of like when I first started teaching English. I taught English as a second language abroad, and I knew I had to cover grammar. I thought, grammar is going to be, like, boring as hell, right? And then I ended up loving grammar. And it's funny, you'd think precepts are pretty dry, but there's something about them that I find very interesting and extremely important. And unfortunately, from my point of view, they don't get emphasized enough. And yet, they are a foundation of the practice. That's the way they were laid out. The Buddha was very clear about it. And yet, you can go to a lot of Buddhist groups, especially in some of the other traditions, they never talk about it, you know? So we're going to talk about it tonight. And so we've covered the first and the second, and this is the third precept, which simply stated is, I undertake the precept to abstain from sexual misconduct. So what does that mean? What is sexual misconduct? What, you know? So, you know, the way the precepts were originally laid out, they were just like, I undertake the precept not to kill. Well, what does that mean? Am I supposed to be a vegetarian? You know, so all of these have sort of nuances to them, and this is no different. So we'll explore that. And I'm going to cover a few topics, but eventually I'm going to really focus on the Eightfold Path, the eight factors of practice that the Buddha laid out as a means to reach awakening from suffering. It's the fourth of the Four Noble Truths, is the Eightfold Path. And within these, and I want to say, I'm going to focus on this as a practice, because that's really what it is. You know, it's not like the Ten, I don't know, my perception growing up Catholic was, we had the Ten Commandments, and it was like, don't do this, and there was no wiggle room. And, you know, if I messed up, then I was in big trouble. Now, that may be a little unfair to describe them that way, but this is definitely not the way we look at the precepts. They're really a practice. And I'd like to look at the focus of our own practice, but I am going to talk a little bit about the role of this precept and sexual misconduct within the broader community, particularly within the Buddhist community. So let's just, I just want to review, if you've been at my talks before on the precepts, this will not be new, but, you know, when we look at the Eightfold Path, it's really divided up into three sections. One section is prajna or pranya, depending on whether you go with Sanskrit or Pali, and that's the wisdom part of the Eightfold Path, and that's really about developing wise understanding and insight. And two of them, which are right view and right intention, fall within that category. Then we have the area of meditation or samadhi, which is effort, concentration, mindfulness, the mental culture of the practice. And there are three involved with that, which were effort, mindfulness, and concentration. Then you have the three, and that's called samadhi, you know. And then you have sila, which is the ethical part. And there are three aspects to that. And that, this is the morality or ethics part, which is speech, action, and livelihood. So you look at these three aspects, And then you think about them as they're laid out in the Eightfold Path. You know, it's 1 through 8, but it's not like we do number one. It's not like we do right view, then right intention, then right speech, right action, go through all of them. And when we get done, we get a little diploma and a t-shirt, and we're good to go. It's not like that. It's like the practices all mixed together. And there's been different descriptions. Some of them say it. You know, I saw Thich Nhat Hanh once. He drew a circle with arrows. You know, you divide like a pie chart, and you go around like this. They all kind of work together. Lee Brazington, who's a teacher of mine, he describes it as like an 8-lane highway. You know, just picture you're in LA, right? And you're just moving from one lane to the other. Maybe using your turn signals, or if you're from LA or Florida, you just go like that, right? Sorry, everybody's from Florida. So they all fit together. Another way I've heard it described is like a house, and that the sila, or the ethical part, is like a foundation. And then once you have that foundation of clear thinking that comes from ethical behavior, then you have the capacity to develop some concentration. I mean, how are we going to stabilize our mind, stabilize our focus, if we're trying to get away with stuff? You know, how are we going to develop any concentration if we're robbing banks and wondering when the cops are going to catch up with us, right? So, but once we practice really ethical behavior, we've probably noticed, all of us, that our life sort of stabilizes and smooths out. Then you have the capacity to develop concentration, those factors in the path. And once we start getting some concentration and focus, then we really start developing wisdom. We start getting insight into how our mind works and how life works. We start grasping the three characteristics of existence, which are dukkha, you know, suffering, impermanence, and non-self. We actually start having direct experience of that, real insight into how that works. So the ethical part is really, really key. And when you put them all together, the ethics and the wisdom and the meditation, it's the threefold training. So I want to point that out because, just to underscore the fact that I think these precepts are really important. The retreats that I go on in this tradition, at the beginning of every retreat, we take the 5 precepts. I'm sure in this retreat that Rania is doing right now at the beginning, they went through the 3 jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, recited those, and then made a commitment to keep the 5 precepts. Why? To establish a foundation and a safe place to do a 4-day retreat. This is how it's done. So, you know, the precepts are a means to an end, and they're observed for a specific objective. On the personal level, the observance of the precepts, they create the groundwork for the cultivation of higher virtues and mental development. And without that, it's very difficult, and that's been my experience. So there's a wonderful book that Thich Nhat Hanh authored called For a Future to Be Possible. This came out a long time ago, probably 25 years ago. For a Future to Be Possible, commentaries on the 5 wonderful precepts, which now he refers to as the 5 mindfulness trainings. And there's contributions by other teachers. And he says, regarding the 3rd precept, refraining from sexual misconduct, so many individuals, children, couples, and families have been destroyed by sexual misconduct. To practice the 3rd precept is to heal ourselves and heal our society. This is mindful living. So we've seen how this has been expanded. In fact, I'm going to read how he now presents the 3rd mindfulness practice. Aware of the suffering caused by sexual misconduct, I am committed to cultivating responsibility and learning ways to protect the safety and integrity of individuals, couples, families, and society. knowing that sexual desire is not the same as love, and that sexual activity motivated by craving always harms myself as well as others, I am determined not to engage in sexual relationships without true love and a deep long-term commitment made known by my friends and family. I will do everything in my power to protect children from sexual abuse and to prevent couples and families from being broken by sexual misconduct. Seeing that body and mind are one, I am committed to learning appropriate ways to take care of my sexual energy and cultivating loving kindness, compassion, joy, and inclusiveness, which are the four basic elements of true love, for my greater happiness and the greater happiness of others. Practicing true love, we know that we will continue beautifully in the future. When I went to a 21-day retreat at Plum Village, and he invited participants at the end to take the five mindfulness trainings, and I did that. And I got a Dharma name, deep determination of, what was it? Deep determination, I think it's called. That was a long time ago. No, and I didn't get a t-shirt. So anyway, you can see that he's really expanded this out as a practice. That's what it is. So looking at it traditionally, you know, if you go back 2,600 years to when the Buddha introduced this, he was primarily teaching to his monks. He had a monastic community. And then sometimes to the lay community. As far as teaching it to the monks, it was pretty cut and dry. I mean, they're supposed to observe celibacy. You know, and they have this Vinaya, you know, all these rules, like, you know, monks, you don't go into town alone, you go together. You know, all these ways to sort of protect yourself from violating this precept. And for the lay population that he occasionally taught to, the Theravadins back then tended to be very conservative on sexual morality. The expectation in traditional society was you were monogamous. And you certainly did not engage in rape, abduction, and adult, you know, any form of adultery, anything, any kind of sexual abuse. In fact, it was so conservative that in a 4th century commentary by Buddhaghosa, he gave such a conservative interpretation, primarily oriented towards men, forbidding homosexuality. So there was a time in the Buddhist tradition where that was seen as sexual deviance and a violation of the third precept. Thank God we've come a long ways. Now, the Buddha did not specifically address homosexuality in any of his discourses. This was a commentary that was done after his death. His Holiness the Dalai Lama has publicly condemned discrimination against and violence against the LGBT community. So, you know, he's really come out strongly. In modern West, among lay people, it would certainly, in most cases, be a breach of this concept, this precept, to have sex outside of any kind of committed sexual relationship, or certainly to have sex involving violence. You know, I think this would be generally accepted as within the Buddhist community as a violation of the precept. But there's a lot of wiggle room in there. Still. And, you know, among Western Buddhists, there tends to be a very liberal attitude. And you'll see this in different lineages. For example, in the Tibetan tradition, part of their culture, polyandry was commonly practiced, a woman having many husbands. So this is still continued on. And within the Buddhist, Tibetan Buddhist tradition, you'll find many tantric practices in the Vajrayana that involve, advanced meditation practices using sexual coupling in meditative states, visualizing one's partner as a symbolic deity. So in their tradition, they will have sexual coupling in a non-committed relationship that is considered part of their practice. You see? So it depends on where you go. So what this does is it now opens the door for me to go to a topic which I thought about whether I wanted to address this, and I decided I wanted to. And this has to do with misconduct within the Buddhist community, particularly among teachers. And I feel that this is a strong point to address. And it's a point that a lot of teachers don't want to cover, you know? Because it's sort of airing dirty laundry in a way. But if you've been around for a while, you know that many, many Buddhist teachers have violated the precept by sleeping with their students. And that's just not okay. And it's not just within the Buddhist tradition. It's in the Hindu tradition. Many, many teachers. Many spiritual. Yoga teachers. We see scandals all the time. Well, certainly in priests, of course. Yeah, that's kind of the big duh. Right? But I tend to be sort of talking about this neighborhood over here. But yeah, priests too. And, you know, we've seen much evidence of this. I'm going to be specific. Any of you, I was kind of wishing Richard would be here because he was very involved with the San Francisco Zen Center. And I lived at the San Francisco Zen Center for 6 years, or 6 months. And early in its history, it was virtually destroyed by a scandal, a sexual scandal, by Richard Baker, who was the lineage holder from Shinryo Suzuki Roshi. It almost completely blew up the largest Zen center outside of Japan. And it wasn't just the sexual misconduct, there were other issues of abuse of power as well. As a result, when I lived there about 9 years ago, they have two abbots now, because they don't want to put the power in the hand of one individual, right? They also had a guideline that I was asked to follow when I got there to avoid any kind of sexual intimate relations for my first year there, which I followed, much to my displeasure. What can I say? But, you know, this was the... And I understood it. I got it. Because it does interfere, you know, just making that intention creates a different attitude towards the practice. Other teachers, if anyone's familiar with... And I'm just putting it right out there, folks. You know? Anyone familiar with the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying? Mm-hmm. Sogyal Rinpoche? He's been involved in numerous scandals. He's been sued. I had a girlfriend back in the early 90s who was a student of his. He tried to make a move on her when she was with him, around him. So, I mean, why does this happen? How does this happen? One of the most notorious ones was Chogyam Trungpa, who founded Naropa Institute and all that, Shambhala, all that. I mean, just slept with students all the time. And why did he do it? Because he could.
Alcoholism.
Yeah. Well, alcoholism certainly contributed to it. Certainly contributed to it. So I met Pema Chodron back in 1991, and I had a conversation with her. Pema Chodron is probably the best-known student of Trungpa, you know, Rinpoche. And I asked her, I said, how can you reconcile what he did? And she said, Eddie, you need to separate the teachings from the teacher. He offered brilliant teachings. And as far as I'm concerned, he was a scumbag. He was a sexual predator. What else do you call him but a scumbag? Hey, I warned you guys. You know, I feel really strongly about this because there's been so much destruction done. Now, why does it happen? I think there are three major reasons. One is, I already talked a little bit about the fact that precepts aren't taught much. I lived in a Tibetan Buddhist center for an entire year, we never discussed the precepts. Not once. And within the community, there were people sleeping together. And at one point, a teacher came in from the East, a Lama. And our teacher actually pointed out that if any of the women in the community wanted to, he would probably be open to sleeping with them, and implied that they might speed up their process to enlightenment by having sexual relationships with a man who might be enlightened. I was appalled. So a lot of this is, I mean, and the precepts weren't being taught there. There was no talk about this precept. We also didn't cover the fifth precept, which has to do with abstaining from intoxicants, and there was an immense amount of alcohol consumed there, going back to your point, with Trungpa. So anyway, whoops. It's only water. Another point, the hierarchical structure. This is a major problem, the hierarchical structure. When you have this authority and this power and this notion that if I get on the good side of the teacher, I can speed up my practice. Thank you. And it's interesting, if you look at the abuse that's happened in Buddhist communities, it tends to happen in the Tibetan and in the Zen traditions, not in the Theravadin. Now, I'm not saying this to play a one-upmanship game and this kind of thing, but isn't it interesting in the Theravadin tradition we don't have the hierarchical structure? When you came in here, you didn't bow to me. You didn't do prostrations to me. I don't have to sit on a higher seat. You know? There's very little hierarchical structure within the Theravadin tradition. So I think what that does not do is create that sense of power that you see in the other traditions. So I'm just bringing this up just to point out, I think, one of the explanations as to why some of this has happened. And to... And if you practice in those other traditions, just be aware of these possibilities. The third reason is the secrecy, the code of silence. We're not going to talk about it. And this has happened virtually in all these scandals. People knew what was going on. And we're not going to talk about it. When I was living at this Tibetan center, there were several of us involved in a several-hour drive from one center to another, and the topic of Trungpa came up, this Shambhala guy. And I made the comment in front of these other practitioners about his sexual misconduct. And I was blasted. How dare you question the motives and actions of an enlightened man? See, there you go. How did it go on? I think we know the answer. So I think in the Dalai Lama himself has had large meetings about this and talked about this. In 2010, there was a prominent teacher in New York, Ito Shimano, who resigned as the head of his Buddhist monastery because of allegations of sexual abuse. Soon after, 90 Zen teachers signed onto a letter expressing their remorse over the alleged sexual assault and this commitment that they had to a culture of silence. They said, "We have pledged now to look and listen to our communities and to build more visible ethic codes, working towards consensus on national standards on behavior and oversight, and seeking outside consultation to educate and empower students to come forward if they are abused." And I say, hallelujah. Let's put it out there. Let's talk about it. Let's be vigilant. And let's hold our teachers to the same standard as the Buddha asked his students and held them to practice and held them to 2,600 years ago. So I'm going to step down off the pulpit and the soapbox now, but I just feel that that's really important to talk about. But let's go through the, I want to go through the Eightfold Path and talk about that in terms of now bringing it back to our own practice. So, let's see here. The Eightfold Path starts with right view. And this is the first practice, and it's one of the wisdom factors, and it's applying the perspective of the Four Noble Truths to our sexual intentions and behavior. And it asks us to consider whether there is any actual or potential suffering to ourselves or to others connected to our sexual behavior. So we're asking ourselves, you know, we're really examining, is there any potential suffering or harm involved with it? It's to notice any cravings or compulsions connected to sexual desire. It's learning to recognize the possibility of the cessation of suffering that might be connected with sexual desire. And it allows us to see it as a means of realizing the peace and sense of fulfillment that comes from dissolving sexual compulsion. Looking at our view. You know, through practicing right view, we really start developing an awareness of suffering, how it arises through our craving, and helps us, you know, to help us be free from suffering. What the Buddha taught for 45 years essentially was the cause of suffering and the sensation of suffering. And we'll have some questions at the end if you can hold on, or did you want to make...
It's relevant.
Go ahead.
As you're going, as you go through the Eightfold Path, it's more and more internal.
Yes.
The question is, isn't the third precept both about mental activity? You're describing all physical activity.
Absolutely, both. Absolutely, mental activity. Absolutely. Because that's where all suffering begins, in the mind. Yeah. So the second part of the second step or factor in the other wisdom factor in the Eightfold Path is right intention. And this is really looking at the deeper and often subconscious motivations that drive our sexual behavior and feelings. And right intention means to avoid the three forms of wrong motivation. These are intentions motivated by cruelty, ill will, and lust. Rape, coerced sex, and sexual aggression are examples of extreme sexual behavior motivated by cruelty. Asserting oneself on one's partner, or ignoring their well-being, what is it driven by? It can be driven by anger, hostility. Are we objectifying our partner? Disrespecting their needs? You know, all this stuff is about motivation. The internal factors. Contrary to this is our intention around sexual behavior motivated by compassion, loving kindness, and renunciation. Sexual behavior can be a powerful way of expressing appreciation, love, and respect for others. So the renunciation part is letting go of any desire that might cause suffering and hurt. So this can have a lot to do with how we handle our sexual energy. And this is something that, you know, at one point I started becoming aware of, is how do I manage my sexual energy? You know, what do I do in situations where, for example, I'm in a committed relationship and I might notice somebody else, right? which is normal and not necessarily unhealthy, but what do I do around that? How do I manage that? Can I bring that in and contain that sexual energy? You know, this is part of the practice. And I'll talk a little bit later, I think, about guarding our senses as well. The third step of the Eightfold Path is right speech. So for our sexual lives to be an integral part of our Buddhist path, it's crucial to tell the truth. Sexual misconduct often involves deceit and secrecy, activities that undermine our efforts to be mindful and transparent. Sexual relationships between people in committed relationships requires honesty as part of the practice. The next one is right action. Now now we're into the ethics part, right? Speech, action, and livelihood. So this is usually explained by the first three precepts, which is abstaining from killing, abstaining from taking things that are not given, and abstaining from sexual misconduct. To take not what is not given freely is very important in sexual relationships. It means not expecting or requiring one's partner to agree to your sexual advances. It means avoiding any assertiveness that forces our will on an unwilling partner, whether we're in relationship with them or not. The next part of the next factor in the Eightfold Path and the third part of the sila or ethical part of the path is right livelihood. And this means participating in an economic life that avoids causing harm, not paying for sex or pornography. Pornography is a multi-billion dollar industry that exploits people. It means not participating in any line of work that perpetuates harmful sexual behavior or attitudes. It could mean not pursuing any livelihood that would create sexualized advertisements. Certainly not supporting any kind of sexual exploitation or dehumanization of others. So the last part, the last three parts, are the factors related to meditation. The first is right effort, first of these three. And this is to make an effort to cultivate skillful, positive states of mind, such as happiness, contentment, calmness, compassion, and equanimity. And these are positive states of mind to cultivate a sense of inner fulfillment and well-being. And in terms of our sexuality, developing these positive states of mind is an antidote to using sex as a way to fill up the inner void. You know, if we're filling that void with these positive states of contentment and compassion and equanimity, we're not leaving ourselves open to trying to fill them up with unhealthy states of mind. And when we have, you know, the pleasure of positive mind state, the physical pleasure of sex may seem less alluring. And, you know, that craving may not pull at us quite as strongly. The seventh in the factor in the practice is mindfulness. And just involving this process of being aware of our mind states, being aware of others, being involved that sex and sexuality involves hormones, social conditioning, beliefs, culture, motivations, emotions, and this mysterious activity of chemistry, just really paying attention and being aware of all that. Sort of unpacking all this complexity and really examining it and looking at it and being aware of how it impacts us. And the last is concentration, and this is really synonymous with this profound sense of calm and well-being. And if we cultivate this ability to have focused awareness and concentration, you know, we really develop a unified mind. And this allows us to really integrate everything. With a strong sense of concentration, we're much less likely to fall victim to being motivated for a desire for recognition, belonging, approval, pleasure, and can really support deep communication, respect, and love for our partner. So I kind of zoomed, you know, through those. I didn't get into them all very deeply, but I'm also aware of wanting to leave time for open sharing.